This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
Chapter 7 of the Oregon Trail. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, Jr. Chapter 7. The Buffalo. 4 days on the Platte and yet no buffalo. Last year's signs of them were provokingly abundant, and wood being extremely scarce, we found an admirable substitute in bois de vache, which burns exactly like peat, producing no unpleasant effects. The wagons one morning had left the camp. Shaw and I were already on horseback, but Henry Chatillon still sat cross-legged by the dead embers of the fire, playing pensively with the lock of his rifle, while his sturdy Wyandotte pony stood quietly behind him, looking over his head. At last he got up, patted the neck of the pony, whom from an exaggerated appreciation of his merits he had christened $500, and then mounted with a melancholy air. "What is it, Henry?" "Ah, I feel lonesome. I never been here before, but I see away yonder over the buttes, and down there on the prairie, black, all black with buffalo." In the afternoon he and I left the party in search of an antelope, until at the distance of a mile or two on the right the tall white wagons and the little black specks of horsemen were just visible, so slowly advancing that they seemed motionless, and far on the left rose the broken line of scorched, desolate sandhills. The vast plain waved with tall rank grass that swept our horses' bellies. It swayed to and fro in billows with a light breeze, and far and near antelope and wolves were moving through it, the hairy backs of the latter alternately appearing and disappearing as they bounded awkwardly along, while the antelope, with the simple curiosity peculiar to them, would often approach as closely, their little horns and white throats just visible above the grass tops as they gazed eagerly at us with their round black eyes. I dismounted and amused myself with firing at the wolves. Henry attentively scrutinized the surrounding landscape. At length he gave a shout and called on me to mount again, pointing in the direction of the sandhills. A mile and a half from us, two minute black specks slowly traversed the face of one of the bare, glaring declivities and disappeared behind the summit. "Let us go," cried Henry, belaboring the sides of $500, and I following in his wake, we galloped rapidly through the rank grass toward the base of the hills. From one of their openings descended a deep ravine, widening as it issued on the prairie. We entered it, and galloping up, in a moment were surrounded by the bleak sandhills. Half of their steep sides were bare, the rest were scantily clothed with clumps of grass and various uncouth plants, conspicuous among which appeared the reptile-like prickly pear. They were gashed with numberless ravines, and, as the sky had suddenly darkened and a cold, gusty wind arisen, the strange shrubs and the dreary hills looked doubly wild and desolate. But Henry's face was all eagerness. He tore off a little hair from the piece of buffalo robe under his saddle, and threw it up to show the course of the wind. It blew directly before us. The game were therefore to windward, and it was necessary to make our best speed to get around them. We scrambled from this ravine, and galloping away through the hollows, soon found another winding like a snake among the hills, and so deep that it completely concealed us. We rode up the bottom of it, glancing through the shrubbery at its edge, till Henry abruptly jerked his rein and slid out of his saddle. Full a quarter of a mile distant, on the outline of the farthest hill, A long procession of buffalo were walking in Indian file with the utmost gravity and deliberation. Then more appeared, clambering from a hollow not far off, and ascending, one behind the other, the grassy slope of another hill. Then a shaggy head and a pair of short broken horns appeared, issuing out of a ravine close at hand, and with a slow, stately step, one by one, the enormous brutes came into view, taking their way across the valley, wholly unconscious of an enemy. In a moment Henry was worming his way, lying flat on the ground, through grass and prickly pears, toward his unsuspecting victims. He had with him both my rifle and his own. He was soon out of sight, and still the buffalo kept issuing into the valley. For a long time all was silent. I sat holding his horse and wondering what he was about, when suddenly, in rapid succession, came the sharp reports of the two rifles, and the whole line of buffalo, quickening their pace into a clumsy trot, gradually disappeared over the ridge of the hill. Henry rose to his feet and stood looking after them. "You have missed them," said I. "Yes," said Henry. "Let us go." He descended into the ravine, loaded the rifles, and mounted his horse. We rode up the hill after the buffalo. The herd was out of sight when we reached the top, but lying on the grass not far off was one quite lifeless, and another violently struggling in the death agony. "You see, I miss him," remarked Henry. He had fired from a distance of more than 150 yards, and both balls had passed through the lungs, the true mark in shooting buffalo. The darkness increased, and a driving storm came on. Tying our horses to the horns of the victims, Henry began the bloody work of dissection, slashing away with the science of a connoisseur, while I vainly endeavored to imitate him. Old Hendrick recoiled with horror and indignation when I endeavored to tie the meat to the strings of rawhide always carried for this purpose, dangling at the back of the saddle. After some difficulty we overcame his scruples, and, heavily burdened with the more eligible portions of the buffalo, we set out on our return. Scarcely had we emerged from the labyrinth of gorges and ravines, and issued upon the open prairie, when the pricking sleet came driving, gust upon gust, directly in our faces. It was strangely dark, though wanting still an hour of sunset. The freezing storm soon penetrated to the skin, but the uneasy trot of our heavy-gaited horses kept us warm enough, as we forced them unwillingly in the teeth of the sleet and rain by the powerful suasion of our Indian whips. The prairie in this place was hard and level. A flourishing colony of prairie dogs had burrowed into it in every direction, and the little mounds of fresh earth around their holes were about as numerous as the hills in a cornfield. But not a yelp was to be heard. Not the nose of a single citizen was visible. All had retired to the depths of their burrows, and we envied them their dry and comfortable habitations. An hour's hard riding showed us our tent dimly looming through the storm, one side puffed out by the force of the wind, and the other collapsed in proportion, while the disconsolate horses stood shivering close around, and the wind kept up a dismal whistling in the boughs of the three old half-dead trees above. Shaw, like a patriarch, sat on his saddle in the entrance, with a pipe in his mouth and his arms folded, contemplating with cool satisfaction the piles of meat that we flung on the ground before him. A dark and dreary night succeeded, but the sun rose with heat so sultry and languid that the captain excused himself on that account from waylaying an old buffalo bull who, with stupid gravity, was walking over the prairie to drink at the river. So much for the climate of the Platte. But it was not the weather alone that had produced this sudden abatement of the sportsmanlike zeal which the captain had always professed. He had been out on the afternoon before, together with several members of his party, but their hunting was attended with no other result than the loss of one of their best horses, severely injured by Sorel in vainly chasing a wounded bull. The captain, whose ideas of hard riding were all derived from transatlantic sources, expressed the utmost amazement at the feats of Sorel, who went leaping ravines and dashing at full speed up and down the sides of precipitous hills, lashing his horse with the recklessness of a Rocky Mountain rider. Unfortunately for the poor animal, he was the property of R., against whom Sorel entertained an unbounded aversion. The captain himself, it seemed, had also attempted to run a buffalo, but though a good and practiced horseman, he had soon given over the attempt, being astonished and utterly disgusted at the nature of the ground he was required to ride over. Nothing unusual occurred on that day, but on the following morning Henry Chatillon, looking over the ocean-like expanse, saw near the foot of the distant hills something that looked like a band of buffalo. He was not sure, he said, but at all events, if they were buffalo, there was a fine chance for a race. Shaw and I at once determined to try the speed of our horses. "Come, Captain, we'll see which can ride hardest, a Yankee or an Irishman." But the captain maintained a grave and austere countenance. He mounted his led horse, however, though very slowly, and we set out at a trot. The game appeared about 3 miles distant. As we proceeded, the captain made various remarks of doubt and indecision, and at length declared he would have nothing to do with such a breakneck business, protesting that he had ridden plenty of steeplechases in his day, but he never knew what riding was till he found himself behind a band of buffalo day before yesterday. "I am convinced," said the captain, "that running is out of the question." Footnote: the method of hunting called running consists in attacking the buffalo on horseback and shooting him with bullets or arrows when at full speed. In approaching, the hunter conceals himself and crawls on the ground toward the game, or lies in wait to kill them. End of footnote. "Take my advice now and don't attempt it. It's dangerous and of no use at all." "Then why did you come out with us? What do you mean to do?" "I shall approach," replied the captain. "You don't mean to approach with your pistols, do you? We have all of us left our rifles in the wagons." The captain seemed staggered at the suggestion. In his characteristic indecision at setting out, pistols, rifles, running, and approaching were mingled in an inextricable medley in his brain. He trotted on in silence between us for a while, but at length he dropped behind and slowly walked his horse back to rejoin the party. Shaw and I kept on, when lo, as we advanced, the band of buffalo were transformed into certain clumps of tall bushes, dotting the prairie for a considerable distance. At this ludicrous termination of our chase, we followed the example of our late ally, and turned back toward the party. We were skirting the brink of a deep ravine when we saw Henry and the broad-chested pony coming toward us at a gallop. "Here's old Pepin and Frederick, down from Fort Laramie," shouted Henry, long before he came up. We had for some days expected this encounter. Pepin was the bourgeois of Fort Laramie. He had come down the river with the buffalo robes and the beaver, the produce of the last winter's trading. I had among our baggage a letter which I wished to commit to their hands, so, requesting Henry to detain the boats if he could until my return, I set out after the wagons. They were about 4 miles in advance. In half an hour I overtook them, got the letter, trotted back upon the trail, and looking carefully as I rode, saw a patch of broken, storm-blasted trees, and moving near them some little black specks like men and horses. Arriving at the place, I found a strange assembly. The boats, 11 in number, deep laden with the skins, hugged close to the shore to escape being borne down by the swift current. The rowers, swarthy, ignoble Mexicans, turned their brutish faces upward to look as I reached the bank. Papin sat in the middle of one of the boats upon the canvas covering that protected the robes. He was a stout, robust fellow with a little gray eye that had a peculiarly sly twinkle. Frederick also stretched his tall, raw-boned proportions close by the bourgeois, and mountain men completed the group, some lounging in the boat, some strolling on shore, some attired in gaily painted buffalo robes like Indian dandies, some with hair saturated with red paint and beplastered with glue to their temples, and one bedaubed with vermilion upon his forehead and each cheek. They were a mongrel race, yet the French blood seemed to predominate. In a few, indeed, might be seen the black snaky eye of the Indian half-breed, and one and all they seemed to aim at assimilating themselves to their savage associates. I shook hands with the bourgeois and delivered the letter. Then the boat swung round into the stream and floated away. They had reason for haste, for already the voyage from Fort Laramie had occupied a full month, and the river was growing daily more shallow. 50 times a day the boats had been aground, indeed. Those who navigate the Platte invariably spend half their time upon sandbars. Two of these boats, the property of private traders, afterwards separating from the rest, got hopelessly involved in the shallows, not very far from the Pawnee villages, and were soon surrounded by a swarm of the inhabitants. They carried off everything that they considered valuable, including most of the robes, and amused themselves by tying up the men left on guard and soundly whipping them with sticks. We encamped that night upon the bank of the river. Among the emigrants there was an overgrown boy some 18 years old, with a head as round and about as large as a pumpkin, and fever and ague fits had dyed his face of a corresponding color. He wore an old white hat tied under his chin with a handkerchief. His body was short and stout, but his legs of disproportioned and appalling length. I observed him at sunset breasting the hill with gigantic strides, and standing against the sky on the summit like a colossal pair of tongs. In a moment after, we heard him screaming frantically behind the ridge, and nothing doubting that he was in the clutches of Indians or grizzly bears, some of the party caught up their rifles and ran to the rescue. His outcries, however, proved but an ebullition of joyous excitement. He had chased two little wolf pups to their burrow, and he was on his knees, grubbing away like a dog at the mouth of the hole to get at them. Before morning, he caused more serious disquiet in the camp. It was his turn to hold the middle guard, but no sooner was he called up than he coolly arranged a pair of saddlebags under a wagon, laid his head upon them, closed his eyes, opened his mouth, and fell asleep. The guard on our side of the camp, thinking it no part of his duty to look after the cattle of the emigrants, contented himself with watching our own horses and mules. The wolves, he said, were unusually noisy, but still no mischief was anticipated, until the sun rose and not a hoof or horn was in sight. The cattle were gone. While Tom was quietly slumbering, the wolves had driven them away. Then we reaped the fruits of R.'s precious plan of traveling in company with the emigrants. To leave them in their distress was not to be thought of, and we felt bound to wait until the cattle could be searched for, and, if possible, recovered. But the reader may be curious to know what punishment awaited the faithless Tom. By the wholesome law of the prairie, he who falls asleep on guard is condemned to walk all day leading his horse by the bridle, and we found much fault with our companions for not enforcing such a sentence on the offender. Nevertheless, had he been of our party, I have no doubt he would in like manner have escaped scot-free. But the emigrants went farther than mere forbearance. They decreed that since Tom couldn't stand guard without falling asleep, he shouldn't stand guard at all, and henceforward his slumbers were unbroken. Establishing such a premium on drowsiness could have no very beneficial effect upon the vigilance of our sentinels, for it is far from agreeable, after riding from sunrise to sunset, to feel your slumbers interrupted by the butt of a rifle nudging your side, and a sleepy voice growling in your ear that you must get up to shiver and freeze for 3 weary hours at midnight. "Buffalo! Buffalo!" It was but a grim old bull roaming the prairie by himself in misanthropic seclusion, but there might be more behind the hills. Dreading the monotony and languor of the camp, Shaw and I saddled our horses, buckled our holsters in their places, and set out with Henry Chatillon in search of the game. Henry, not intending to take part in the chase, but merely conducting us, carried his rifle with him, while we left ours behind as encumbrances. We rode for some 5 or 6 miles, and saw no living thing but wolves, snakes, and prairie dogs. "This won't do at all," said Shaw. "What won't do?" "There's no wood about here to make a litter for the wounded man. I have an idea that one of us will need something of the sort before the day is over." There was some foundation for such an apprehension, for the ground was none of the best for a race, and grew worse continually as we proceeded. Indeed, it soon became desperately bad, consisting of abrupt hills and deep hollows cut by frequent ravines not easy to pass. At length, a mile in advance, we saw a band of bulls. Some were scattered, grazing over a green declivity, while the rest were crowded more densely together in the wide hollow below. Making a circuit to keep out of sight, we rode toward them until we ascended a hill within a furlong of them, beyond which nothing intervened that could possibly screen us from their view. We dismounted behind the ridge just out of sight, drew our saddle girths, examined our pistols, and, mounting again, rode over the hill and descended at a canter toward them, bending close to our horses' necks. Instantly they took the alarm. Those on the hill descended, those below gathered into a mass, and the whole got in motion, shouldering each other along at a clumsy gallop. We followed, spurring our horses to full speed, and as the herd rushed, crowding and trampling in terror through an opening in the hills, we were close at their heels, half suffocated by the clouds of dust. But as we drew near, their alarm and speed increased. Our horses showed signs of the utmost fear, bounding violently aside as we approached, and refusing to enter among the herd. The buffalo now broke into several small bodies, scampering over the hills in different directions, and I lost sight of Shaw. Neither of us knew where the other had gone. Old Pontiac ran like a frantic elephant, uphill and downhill, his ponderous hoofs striking the prairie like sledgehammers. He showed a curious mixture of eagerness and terror, straining to overtake the panic-stricken herd, but constantly recoiling in dismay as we drew near. The fugitives, indeed, offered no very attractive spectacle, with their enormous size and weight, their shaggy manes and the tattered remnants of their last winter's hair covering their backs in irregular shreds and patches and flying off in the wind as they ran. At length I urged my horse close behind a bull, and after trying in vain by blows and spurring to bring him alongside, I shot a bullet into the buffalo from this disadvantageous position. At the report, Pontiac swerved so much that I was again thrown a little behind the game. The bullet, entering too much in the rear, failed to disable the bull, for a buffalo requires to be shot at particular points, or he will certainly escape. The herd ran up a hill, and I followed in pursuit. As Pontiac rushed headlong down on the other side, I saw Shaw and Henry descending the hollow on the right at a leisurely gallop, and in front the buffalo were just disappearing behind the crest of the next hill, their short tails erect and their hoofs twinkling through a cloud of dust. At that moment I heard Shaw and Henry shouting to me, but the muscles of a stronger arm than mine could not have checked at once the furious course of Pontiac, whose mouth was as insensible as leather. Added to this, I rode him that morning with a common snaffle, having the day before, for the benefit of my other horse, unbuckled from my bridle the curb which I ordinarily used. A stronger and hardier brute never trod the prairie. But the novel sight of the buffalo filled him with terror, and when at full speed he was almost incontrollable. Gaining the top of the ridge, I saw nothing of the buffalo. They had all vanished amid the intricacies of the hills and hollows. Reloading my pistols in the best way I could, I galloped on until I saw them again scuttling along at the base of the hill, their panic somewhat abated. Down went old Pontiac among them, scattering them to the right and left, and then we had another long chase. About a dozen bulls were before us, scouring over the hills, rushing down the declivities with tremendous weight and impetuosity, and then laboring with a weary gallop upward. Still Pontiac, in spite of spurring and beating, would not close with them. One bull at length fell a little behind the rest, and by dint of much effort I urged my horse within 6 or 8 yards of his side. His back was darkened with sweat. He was panting heavily, while his tongue lolled out a foot from his jaws. Gradually I came up abreast of him, urging Pontiac with leg and rein nearer to his side. Then suddenly he did what buffalo in such circumstances will always do. He slackened his gallop, and turning toward us with an aspect of mingled rage and distress, lowered his huge shaggy head for a charge. Pontiac, with a snort, leapt aside in terror, nearly throwing me to the ground, as I was wholly unprepared for such an evolution. I raised my pistol in a passion to strike him on the head, but, thinking better of it, fired the bullet after the bull, who had resumed his flight, then drew rein and determined to rejoin my companions. It was high time. The breath blew hard from Pontiac's nostrils, and the sweat rolled in big drops down his sides. I myself felt as if drenched in warm water. Pledging myself, and I redeemed the pledge, to take my revenge at a future opportunity, I looked round for some indications to show me where I was and what course I ought to pursue. I might as well have looked for landmarks in the midst of the ocean. How many miles I had run, or in what direction, I had no idea. and around me the prairie was rolling in steep swells and pitches, without a single distinctive feature to guide me. I had a little compass hung at my neck, and ignorant that the Platte at this point diverged considerably from its easterly course, I thought that by keeping to the northward I should certainly reach it. So I turned and rode about 2 hours in that direction. The prairie changed as I advanced, softening away into easier undulations, but nothing like the Platte appeared, nor any sign of a human being. The same wild, endless expanse lay around me still, and to all appearance I was as far from my object as ever. I began now to consider myself in danger of being lost, and therefore, reining in my horse, summoned the scanty share of woodcraft that I possessed, if that term be applicable upon the prairie, to extricate me. Looking round, it occurred to me that the buffalo might prove my best guides. I soon found one of the paths made by them in their passage to the river. It ran nearly at right angles to my course, but turning my horse's head in the direction it indicated, his freer gait and erected ears assured me that I was right. But in the meantime, my ride had been by no means a solitary one. The whole face of the country was dotted far and wide with countless hundreds of buffalo. They trooped along in files and columns, bulls, cows, and calves, on the green faces of the declivities in front. They scrambled away over the hills to the right and left, and far off the pale blue swells in the extreme distance were dotted with innumerable specks. Sometimes I surprised shaggy old bulls grazing alone or sleeping behind the ridges I ascended. They would leap up at my approach, stare stupidly at me through their tangled manes, and then gallop heavily away. The antelope were very numerous, and as they are always bold when in the neighborhood of buffalo, they would approach quite near to look at me, gazing intently with their great round eyes, then suddenly leap aside and stretch lightly away over the prairie as swiftly as a racehorse. Squalid, ruffian-like wolves sneaked through the hollows and sandy ravines. Several times I passed through villages of prairie dogs, who sat each at the mouth of his burrow, holding his paws before him in a supplicating attitude, and yelping away most vehemently, energetically whisking his little tail with every squeaking cry he uttered. Prairie dogs are not fastidious in their choice of companions. Various long checkered snakes were sunning themselves in the midst of the village, and demure little gray owls with a large white ring around each eye were perched side by side with the rightful inhabitants. The prairie teemed with life. Again and again I looked toward the crowded hillsides and was sure I saw horsemen, and riding near with a mixture of hope and dread, for Indians were abroad, I found them transformed into a group of buffalo. There was nothing in human shape amid all this vast congregation of brute forms. When I turned down the buffalo path, the prairie seemed changed. Only a wolf or two glided past at intervals, like conscious felons, never looking to the right or left. Being now free from anxiety, I was at leisure to observe minutely the objects around me, and here, for the first time, I noticed insects wholly different from any of the varieties found farther to the eastward. Gaudy butterflies fluttered about my horse's head. Strangely formed beetles, glittering with metallic luster, were crawling upon plants that I had never seen before. Multitudes of lizards, too, were darting like lightning over the sand. I had run to a great distance from the river. It cost me a long ride on the buffalo path before I saw from the ridge of a sand hill the pale surface of the Platte glistening in the midst of its desert valleys, and the faint outline of the hills beyond waving along the sky. From where I stood, not a tree nor a bush nor a living thing was visible throughout the whole extent of the sun-scorched landscape. In half an hour I came upon the trail not far from the river, and seeing that the party had not yet passed, I turned eastward to meet them, old Pontiac's long swinging trot again assuring me that I was right in doing so. Having been slightly ill on leaving camp in the morning, 6 or 7 hours of rough riding had fatigued me extremely. I soon stopped, therefore, flung my saddle on the ground, and with my head resting on it and my horse's trail rope tied loosely to my arm, lay waiting the arrival of the party, speculating meanwhile on the extent of the injuries Pontiac had received. At length the white wagon coverings rose from the verge of the plain. by a singular coincidence, almost at the same moment, two horsemen appeared coming down from the hills. They were Shaw and Henry, who had searched for me a while in the morning, but well knowing the futility of the attempt in such broken country, had placed themselves on the top of the highest hill they could find, and picketing their horses near them, as a signal to me, had laid down and fallen asleep. The stray cattle had been recovered, as the emigrants told us, about noon. Before sunset, we pushed forward 8 miles farther. June 7, 1846. Four men are missing, R., Sorel, and two emigrants. They set out this morning after buffalo and have not yet made their appearance. Whether killed or lost, we cannot tell. I find the above in my notebook, and well remember the council held on the occasion. Our fire was the scene of it, or the palpable superiority of Henry Chatillon's experience and skill made him the resort of the whole camp upon every question of difficulty. He was molding bullets at the fire when the captain drew near with a perturbed and careworn expression of countenance, faithfully reflected on the heavy features of Jack, who followed close behind. Then emigrants came straggling from their wagons toward the common center. Various suggestions were made to account for the absence of the four men, and one or two of the emigrants declared that when out after the cattle they had seen Indians dogging them and crawling like wolves along the ridges of the hills. At this time the captain slowly shook his head with double gravity and solemnly remarked, "It's a serious thing to be traveling through this cursed wilderness," an opinion in which Jack immediately expressed a thorough coincidence. Henry would not commit himself by declaring any positive opinion. "Maybe he only follow the buffalo too far. Maybe Indian kill him. Maybe he got lost. I cannot tell." With this, the auditors were obliged to rest content. The emigrants, not in the least alarmed, though curious to know what had become of their comrades, walked back to their wagons, and the captain betook himself pensively to his tent. Shaw and I followed his example. "It will be a bad thing for our plans," said he as we entered, "if these fellows don't get back safe. The captain is as helpless on the prairie as a child. We shall have to take him and his brother in tow. They will hang on us like lead." "The prairie is a strange place," said I. "A month ago I should have thought it rather a startling affair to have an acquaintance ride out in the morning and lose his scalp before night. But here it seems the most natural thing in the world. Not that I believe that R. has lost his yet. If a man is constitutionally liable to nervous apprehensions, a tour on the distant prairies would prove the best prescription. For though when in the neighborhood of the Rocky Mountains he may at times find himself placed in circumstances of some danger, I believe that few ever breathe that reckless atmosphere without becoming almost indifferent to any evil chance that may befall themselves or their friends." Shaw had a propensity for luxurious indulgence. He spread his blanket with the utmost accuracy on the ground, picked up the sticks and stones that he thought might interfere with his comfort, adjusted his saddle to serve as a pillow, and composed himself for his night's rest. I had the first guard that evening, so, taking my rifle, I went out of the tent. It was perfectly dark. A brisk wind blew down from the hills, and the sparks from the fire were streaming over the prairie. One of the emigrants, named Morton, was my companion, and laying our rifles on the grass, we sat down together by the fire. Morton was a Kentuckian, an athletic fellow, with a fine, intelligent face, and in his manners and conversation he showed the essential characteristics of a gentleman. Our conversation turned on the pioneers of his gallant native state. The 3 hours of our watch dragged away at last, and we went to call up the relief. R's guard succeeded mine. He was absent, but the captain, anxious lest the camp should be left defenseless, had volunteered to stand in his place, so I went to wake him up. There was no occasion for it, for the captain had been awake since nightfall. A fire was blazing outside of the tent, and by the light which struck through the canvas I saw him and Jack lying on their backs with their eyes wide open. The captain responded instantly to my call. He jumped up, seized the double-barreled rifle, and came out of the tent with an air of solemn determination, as if about to devote himself to the safety of the party. I went and lay down, not doubting that for the next 3 hours our slumbers would be guarded with sufficient vigilance. End of chapter 7. Chapter 8 of the Oregon Trail. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, Jr. Chapter 8. Taking French Leave. On the 8th of June, at 11 o'clock, we reached the South Fork of the Platte, at the usual fording place. For league upon league, the desert uniformity of the prospect was almost unbroken. The hills were dotted with little tufts of shriveled grass, but betwixt these the white sand was glaring in the sun, and the channel of the river, almost on a level with the plain, was but one great sandbed, about half a mile wide. It was covered with water, but so scantily that the bottom was scarcely hidden, for wide as it is, the average depth of the Platte does not at this point exceed a foot and a half. Stopping near its bank, we gathered bois de vache and made a meal of buffalo meat. Far off on the other side was a green meadow where we could see the white tents and wagons of an emigrant camp, and just opposite to us we could discern a group of men and animals at the water's edge. Four or five horsemen soon entered the river, and in 10 minutes had waded across and clambered up the loose sandbank. They were ill-looking fellows, thin and swarthy, with careworn, anxious faces and lips rigidly compressed. They had good cause for anxiety. It was 3 days since they first encamped here, and on the night of their arrival they had lost 123 of their best cattle, driven off by the wolves through the neglect of the man on guard. This discouraging and alarming calamity was not the first that had overtaken them. Since leaving the settlements they had met with nothing but misfortune. Some of their party had died. One man had been killed by the Pawnees, and about a week before they had been plundered by the Dakotas of all their best horses, the wretched animals on which our visitors were mounted being the only ones that were left. They had encamped, they told us, near sunset by the side of the Platte, and their oxen were scattered over the meadow, while the band of horses were feeding a little farther off. Suddenly the ridges of the hills were alive with a swarm of mounted Indians, at least 600 in number, who with a tremendous yell came pouring down toward the camp, rushing up within a few rods, to the great terror of the emigrants. But suddenly wheeling, they swept around the band of horses, and in 5 minutes had disappeared with their prey through the openings of the hills. As these emigrants were telling their story, we saw four other men approaching. They proved to be R. and his companions, who had encountered no mischance of any kind, but had only wandered too far in pursuit of the game. They said they had seen no Indians, but only millions of buffalo, and both R. and Sorel had meat dangling behind their saddles. The emigrants recrossed the river, and we prepared to follow. First the heavy ox wagons plunged down the bank and dragged slowly over the sand beds. Sometimes the hoofs of the oxen were scarcely wetted by the thin sheet of water, and the next moment the river would be boiling against their sides and eddying fiercely around the wheels. Inch by inch they receded from the shore, dwindling every moment, until at length they seemed to be floating far in the very middle of the river. A more critical experiment awaited us, for our little mule cart was but ill-fitted for the passage of so swift a stream. We watched it with anxiety till it seemed to be a little motionless white speck in the midst of the waters, and it was motionless, for it had stuck fast in a quicksand. The little mules were losing their footing, the wheels were sinking deeper and deeper, and the water began to rise through the bottom and drench the goods within. All of us who had remained on the hither bank galloped to the rescue. The men jumped into the water, adding their strength to that of the mules, until by much effort the cart was extricated and conveyed in safety across. As we gained the other bank, a rough group of men surrounded us. They were not robust, nor large of frame, yet they had an aspect of hardy endurance. Finding at home no scope for their fiery energies, they had betaken themselves to the prairie. and in them seemed to be revived with redoubled force that fierce spirit which impelled their ancestors, scarce more lawless than themselves, from the German forests, to inundate Europe and break to pieces the Roman Empire. A fortnight afterward this unfortunate party passed Fort Laramie while we were there. Not one of their missing oxen had been recovered, though they had remained encamped a week in search of them, and they had been compelled to abandon a great part of their baggage and provisions, and yoke cows and heifers to their wagons to carry them forward upon their journey, the most toilsome and hazardous part of which lay still before them. It is worth noticing that on the Platte one may sometimes see the shattered wrecks of ancient claw-footed tables, well waxed and rubbed, or massive bureaus of carved oak. These, many of them no doubt the relics of ancestral prosperity in the colonial time, must have encountered strange vicissitudes, imported perhaps originally from England, then with declining fortunes of their owners, borne across the Alleghenies to the remote wilderness of Ohio or Kentucky, then to Illinois or Missouri, and now at last fondly stowed away in the family wagon for the interminable journey to Oregon. But the stern privations of the way are little anticipated. The cherished relic is soon flung out to scorch and crack upon the hot prairie. We resumed our journey, but we had gone scarcely a mile when R. called out from the rear, "We'll camp here." "Why do you want to camp? Look at the sun, it's not 3 o'clock yet." "We'll camp here." This was the only reply vouchsafed. Delorier was in advance with his cart. Seeing the mule wagon wheeling from the track, he began to turn his own team in the same direction. "Go on, Delorier," and the little cart advanced again. As we rode on, we soon heard the wagon of our Confederates creaking and jolting on behind us, and the driver, Wright, discharging a furious volley of oaths against his mules, no doubt venting upon them the wrath which he dared not direct against a more appropriate object. Something of this sort had frequently occurred. Our English friend was by no means partial to us, and we thought we discovered in his conduct a deliberate intention to thwart and annoy us, especially by retarding the movements of the party, which he knew that we, being Yankees, were anxious to quicken. Therefore, he would insist on encamping at all unseasonable hours, saying that 15 miles was a sufficient day's journey. Finding our wishes systematically disregarded, we took the direction of affairs into our own hands, keeping always in advance, to the inexpressible indignation of R. We encamped at what time and place we thought proper, not much caring whether the rest chose to follow or not. They always did so, however, pitching their tents near ours with sullen and wrathful countenances. Traveling together on these agreeable terms did not suit our tastes. For some time we had meditated a separation. The connection with this party had cost us various delays and inconveniences, and the glaring want of courtesy and good sense displayed by their virtual leader did not dispose us to bear these annoyances with much patience. We resolved to leave camp early in the morning, and push forward as rapidly as possible for Fort Laramie, which we hoped to reach by hard traveling in 4 or 5 days. The captain soon trotted up between us, and we explained our intentions. "A very extraordinary proceeding, upon my word," he remarked. Then he began to enlarge upon the enormity of the design. The most prominent impression in his mind, evidently, was that we were acting a base and treacherous part in deserting his party, in what he considered a very dangerous stage of the journey. To palliate the atrocity of our conduct, we ventured to suggest that we were only 4 in number, while his party still included 16 men. And as, moreover, we were to go forward and they were to follow, at least a full proportion of the perils he apprehended would fall upon us. But the austerity of the captain's features would not relax. "A very extraordinary proceeding, gentlemen." And repeating this, he rode off to confer with his principal. By good luck, we found a meadow of fresh grass and a large pool of rainwater in the midst of it. We encamped here at sunset. Plenty of buffalo skulls were lying around, bleaching in the sun, and sprinkled thickly among the grass was a great variety of strange flowers. I had nothing else to do, and so gathering a handful, I sat down on a buffalo skull to study them. although the offspring of a wilderness, their texture was frail and delicate, and their colors extremely rich, pure white, dark blue, and a transparent crimson. One traveling in this country seldom has leisure to think of anything but the stern features of the scenery and its accompaniments, or the practical details of each day's journey. Like them, he and his thoughts grow hard and rough. But now these flowers suddenly awakened a train of associations as alien to the rude scene around me as they were themselves, and for the moment my thoughts went back to New England. A throng of fair and well-remembered faces rose, vividly as life, before me. There are good things, thought I, in the savage life. But what can it offer to replace those powerful and ennobling influences that can reach unimpaired over more than 3,000 miles of mountains, forests, and deserts? Before sunrise on the next morning, our tent was down. We harnessed our best horses to the cart and left the camp. But first we shook hands with our friends, the emigrants, who sincerely wished us a safe journey, though some others of the party might easily have been consoled had we encountered an Indian war party on the way. The captain and his brother were standing on the top of a hill, wrapped in their plaids, like spirits of the mist, keeping an anxious eye on the band of horses below. We waved adieu to them as we rode off the ground. The captain replied with a salutation of the utmost dignity, which Jack tried to imitate, but being little practiced in the gestures of polite society, his effort was not a very successful one. In 5 minutes we had gained the foot of the hills, but here we came to a stop. Old Hendrick was in the shafts, and being the very incarnation of perverse and brutish obstinacy, he utterly refused to move. Delorier lashed and swore till he was tired, but Hendrick stood like a rock, grumbling to himself and looking askance at his enemy, until he saw a favorable opportunity to take his revenge, when he struck out under the shaft with such cool malignity of intention that Delorier only escaped the blow by a sudden skip into the air, such as no one but a Frenchman could achieve. Shaw and he then joined forces and lashed on both sides at once. The brute stood still for a while till he could bear it no longer, when all at once he began to kick and plunge till he threatened the utter demolition of the cart and harness. We glanced back at the camp, which was in full sight. Our companions, inspired by emulation, were leveling their tents and driving in their cattle and horses. "Take the horse out," said I. I took the saddle from Pontiac and put it upon Hendrick. The former was harnessed to the cart in an instant. "Avance donc," cried Delorier. Pontiac strode up the hill, twitching the little cart after him as if it were a feather's weight, and though as we gained the top we saw the wagons of our deserted comrades just getting into motion, we had little fear that they could overtake us. Leaving the trail, we struck directly across the country and took the shortest cut to reach the main stream of the Platte. A deep ravine suddenly intercepted us. We skirted its side until we found them less abrupt, and then plunged through the best way we could. Passing behind the sandy ravines called Ash Hollow, we stopped for a short nooning at the side of a pool of rainwater, but soon resumed our journey, and some hours before sunset were descending the ravines and gorges opening downward upon the Platte to the west of Ash Hollow. Our horses waded to the fetlock in sand, the sun scorched like fire, and the air swarmed with sandflies and mosquitoes. At last we gained the Platte. Following it for about 5 miles, we saw, just as the sun was sinking, a great meadow dotted with hundreds of cattle, and beyond them an emigrant encampment. A party of about a dozen came out to meet us, looking upon us at first with cold and suspicious faces. Seeing 4 men, different in appearance and equipment from themselves, emerging from the hills, they had taken us for the van of the much-dreaded Mormons, whom they were very apprehensive of encountering. We made known our true character, and then they greeted us cordially. They expressed much surprise that so small a party should venture to traverse that region, though in fact such attempts are not unfrequently made by trappers and Indian traders. We rode with them to their camp. The wagons, some 50 in number, with here and there a tent intervening, were arranged, as usual, in a circle. In the area within, the best horses were picketed, and the whole circumference was glowing with the dusky light of the fires, displaying the forms of the women and children who were crowded around them. This patriarchal scene was curious and striking enough, but we made our escape from the place with all possible dispatch, being tormented by the intrusive curiosity of the men who crowded around us. Yankee curiosity was nothing to theirs. They demanded our names, where we came from, where we were going, and what was our business. The last query was particularly embarrassing, since traveling in that country, or indeed anywhere, from any other motive than gain, was an idea of which they took no cognizance. Yet they were fine-looking fellows, with an air of frankness, generosity, and even courtesy, having come from one of the least barbarous of the frontier counties. We passed about a mile beyond them and encamped. Being too few in number to stand guard without excessive fatigue, we extinguished our fire, lest it should attract the notice of wandering Indians, and, picketing our horses close around us, slept undisturbed till morning. For 3 days we traveled without interruption, and on the evening of the third encamped by the well-known spring on Scott's Bluff. Henry Chatillon and I rode out in the morning, and descending the western side of the bluff, were crossing the plain beyond. Something that seemed to me a file of buffalo came into view, descending the hill several miles before us. But Henry reined in his horse, and keenly peering across the prairie with a better and more practiced eye, soon discovered its real nature. "Indians," he said. "Old Smoke's lodges, I believe. Come, let us go. Wah! Get up now, $500. And laying on the lash with good will, he galloped forward, and I rode by his side. Not long after, a black speck became visible on the prairie, full 2 miles off. It grew larger and larger. It assumed the form of a man and horse, and soon we could discern a naked Indian careering at full gallop toward us. When within a furlong, he wheeled his horse in a wide circle and made him describe various mystic figures upon the prairie, and Henry immediately compelled $500 to execute similar evolutions. "It is Old Smoke's village," said he, interpreting these signals. "Didn't I say so?" As the Indian approached, we stopped to wait for him, when suddenly he vanished, sinking, as it were, into the earth. He had come upon one of the deep ravines that everywhere intersect these prairies. In an instant the rough head of his horse stretched upward from the edge, and the rider and steed came scrambling out and bounded up to us. A sudden jerk of the rein brought the wild, panting horse to a full stop. Then followed the needful formality of shaking hands. I forget our visitor's name. He was a young fellow of no note in his nation, yet in his person and equipments he was a good specimen of a Dakota warrior in his ordinary traveling dress. Like most of his people, he was nearly 6 feet high, lithely and gracefully, yet strongly proportioned, and with a skin singularly clear and delicate. He wore no paint. His head was bare, and his long hair was gathered in a clump behind, to the top of which was attached transversely, both by way of ornament and of talisman, the mystic whistle, made of the wing-bone of the war-eagle, and endowed with various magic virtues. From the back of his head descended a line of glittering brass plates, tapering from the size of a doubloon to that of a half-dime, a cumbrous ornament in high vogue among the Dakotas, and for which they pay the traders a most extravagant price. His chest and arms were naked. The buffalo robe, worn over them when at rest, had fallen about his waist and was confined there by a belt. This, with the gay moccasins on his feet, completed his attire. For arms, he carried a quiver of dogskin at his back and a rude but powerful bow in his hand. His horse had no bridle. A cord of hair lashed around his jaw served in place of one. The saddle was of most singular construction. It was made of wood covered with rawhide, and both pommel and cantle rose perpendicularly full 18 inches, so that the warrior was wedged firmly in his seat, whence nothing could dislodge him but the bursting of the girths. Advancing with our new companion, we found more of his people seated in a circle on the top of a hill, while a rude procession came straggling down the neighboring hollow, men, women, and children, with horses dragging lodge-poles behind them. All that morning, as we moved forward, tall savages were stalking silently about us. At noon we reached Horse Creek, and as we waded through the shallow water, we saw a wild and striking scene. The main body of the Indians had arrived before us. On the farther bank stood a large and strong man, nearly naked, holding a white horse by a long cord, and eyeing us as we approached. This was the chief, whom Henry called Old Smoke. Just behind him, his youngest and favorite squaw sat astride of a fine mule. It was covered with caparisons of whitened skins, garnished with blue and white beads, and fringed with little ornaments of metal that tinkled with every movement of the animal. The girl had a light, clear complexion, enlivened by a spot of vermilion on each cheek. She smiled, not to say grinned upon us, showing two gleaming rows of white teeth. In her hand she carried the tall lance of her unchivalrous lord, fluttering with feathers. His round white shield hung at the side of her mule, and his pipe was slung at her back. Her dress was a tunic of deerskin, made beautifully white by means of a species of clay found on the prairie, and ornamented with beads arrayed in figures more gay than tasteful, and with long fringes at all the seams. Not far from the chief stood a group of stately figures, their white buffalo robes thrown over their shoulders, gazing coldly upon us. And in the rear, for several acres, the ground was covered with a temporary encampment. Men, women, and children swarmed like bees. Hundreds of dogs of all sizes and colors ran restlessly about, and close at hand the wide shallow stream was alive with boys, girls, and young squaws, splashing, screaming, and laughing in the water. At the same time a long train of emigrant wagons were crossing the creek, and, dragging on in their slow, heavy procession, past the encampment of the people whom they and their descendants, in the space of a century, are to sweep from the face of the earth. The encampment itself was merely a temporary one during the heat of the day. None of the lodges were erected, but their heavy leather coverings and the long poles used to support them were scattered everywhere around, among weapons, domestic utensils, and the rude harness of mules and horses. The squaws of each lazy warrior had made him a shelter from the sun by stretching a few buffalo robes or the corner of a lodge covering upon poles, and here he sat in the shade, with a favorite young squaw perhaps at his side, glittering with all imaginable trinkets. Before him stood the insignia of his rank as a warrior, his white shield of bullhide, his medicine bag, his bow and quiver, his lance and his pipe, raised aloft on a tripod of three poles. Except the dogs, the most active and noisy tenants of the camp were the old women, ugly as Macbeth's witches, with their hair streaming loose in the wind, and nothing but the tattered fragment of an old buffalo robe to hide their shriveled, wiry limbs. The day of their favoritism passed two generations ago. Now the heaviest labors of the camp devolved upon them. They were to harness the horses, pitch the lodges, dress the buffalo robes, and bring in meat for the hunters. With the cracked voices of these hags, the clamor of dogs, the shouting and laughing of children and girls, and the listless tranquility of the warriors, the whole scene had an effect too lively and picturesque ever to be forgotten. We stopped not far from the Indian camp, and having invited some of the chiefs and warriors to dinner, placed before them a sumptuous repast of biscuit and coffee. Squatted in a half circle on the ground, they soon disposed of it. As we rode forward on the afternoon journey, several of our late guests accompanied us. Among the rest was a huge, bloated savage of more than 300 pounds weight, christened Le Cochon in consideration of his preposterous dimensions and certain corresponding traits of his character. The hog bestrode a little white pony, scarce able to bear up under the enormous burden, though by way of keeping up the necessary stimulus, the rider kept both feet in constant motion, playing alternately against his ribs. The old man was not a chief. He never had ambition enough to become one. He was not a warrior nor a hunter, for he was too fat and lazy, but he was the richest man in the whole village. Riches among the Dakotas consist in horses, and of these the hog had accumulated more than 30. He had already 10 times as many as he wanted, yet still his appetite for horses was insatiable. Trotting up to me, he shook me by the hand, and gave me to understand that he was a very devoted friend. And then he began a series of most earnest signs and gesticulations, his oily countenance radiant with smiles, and his little eyes peeping out with a cunning twinkle from between the masses of flesh that almost obscured them. Knowing nothing at that time of the sign language of the Indians, I could only guess at his meaning, so I called on Henry to explain it. The hog, it seems, was anxious to conclude a matrimonial bargain. He said he had a very pretty daughter in his lodge whom he would give me if I would give him my horse. These flattering overtures I chose to reject, at which the hog, still laughing with undiminished good humor, gathered his robe about his shoulders and rode away. Where we encamped that night, an arm of the Platte ran between high bluffs. It was turbid and swift as heretofore, but trees were growing on its crumbling banks, and there was a nook of grass between the water and the hill. Just before entering this place, we saw the emigrants encamping at 2 or 3 miles distance on the right, while the whole Indian rabble were pouring down the neighboring hill in hope of the same sort of entertainment which they had experienced from us. In the savage landscape before our camp, nothing but the rushing of the Platte broke the silence. Through the ragged boughs of the trees, dilapidated and half-dead, we saw the sun setting in crimson behind the peaks of the Black Hills. The restless bosom of the river was suffused with red. Our white tent was tinged with it, and the sterile bluffs, up to the rocks that crowned them, partook of the same fiery hue. It soon passed away. No light remained but that from our fire, blazing high among the dusky trees and bushes. We lay around it wrapped in our blankets, smoking and conversing until a late hour, and then withdrew to our tent. We crossed a sun-scorched plain on the next morning, the line of old cottonwood trees that fringed the bank of the Platte forming its extreme verge. Nestled apparently close beneath them, we could discern in the distance something like a building. As we came nearer, it assumed form and dimensions, and proved to be a rough structure of logs. It was a little trading fort belonging to 2 private traders, and originally intended, like all the forts of the country, to form a hollow square with rooms for lodging and storage opening upon the area within. Only 2 sides of it had been completed. The place was now as ill-fitted for the purposes of defense as any of those little log houses, which upon our constantly shifting frontier have been so often successfully maintained against overwhelming odds of Indians. 2 lodges were pitched close to the fort. The sun beat scorching upon the logs. No living thing was stirring except 1 old squaw, who thrust her round head from the opening of the nearest lodge, and 3 or 4 stout young pups who were peeping with looks of eager inquiry from under the covering. In a moment a door opened, and a little swarthy black-eyed Frenchman came out. His dress was rather singular. His black curling hair was parted in the middle of his head and fell below his shoulders. He wore a tight frock of smoked deerskin, very gaily ornamented with figures worked in dyed porcupine quills. His moccasins and leggings were also gaudily adorned in the same manner, and the latter had in addition a line of long fringes reaching down the seams. The small frame of Richard, for by this name Henry made him known to us, was in the highest degree athletic and vigorous. There was no superfluity, and indeed there seldom is among the active white men of this country, but every limb was compact and hard, every sinew had its full tone and elasticity, and the whole man wore an air of mingled hardihood and buoyancy. Richard committed our horses to a Navajo slave, a mean-looking fellow taken prisoner on the Mexican frontier, and, relieving us of our rifles with ready politeness, led the way into the principal apartment of his establishment. This was a room 10 feet square. The walls and floor were of black mud, and the roof of rough timber. There was a huge fireplace made of 4 flat rocks picked up on the prairie. An Indian bow and otter-skin quiver, several gaudy articles of Rocky Mountain finery, an Indian medicine bag, and a pipe and tobacco pouch garnished the walls, and rifles rested in a corner. There was no furniture except a sort of rough settle covered with buffalo robes, upon which lolled a tall half-breed, with his hair glued in masses upon each temple, and saturated with vermilion. 2 or 3 more mountain men sat cross-legged on the floor. Their attire was not unlike that of Richard himself, but the most striking figure of the group was a naked Indian boy of 16, with a handsome face and light active proportions, who sat in an easy posture in the corner near the door. Not one of his limbs moved the breadth of a hair. His eye was fixed immovably, not on any person present, but, as it appeared, on the projecting corner of the fireplace opposite to him. On these prairies, the custom of smoking with friends is seldom omitted, whether among Indians or whites. The pipe, therefore, was taken from the wall, and its great red bowl crammed with the tobacco and shongsasha mixed in suitable proportions. Then it passed round the circle, each man inhaling a few whiffs and handing it to his neighbor. Having spent half an hour here, we took our leave, first inviting our new friends to drink a cup of coffee with us at our camp a mile farther up the river. By this time, as the reader may conceive, we had grown rather shabby. Our clothes had burst into rags and tatters, and what was worse, we had very little means of renovation. Fort Laramie was but 7 miles before us. Being totally averse to appearing in such plight among any society that could boast an approximation to the civilized, we soon stopped by the river to make our toilet in the best way we could. We hung up small looking glasses against the trees and shaved, an operation neglected for 6 weeks. We performed our ablutions in the Platte, though the utility of such a proceeding was questionable, the water looking exactly like a cup of chocolate, and the banks consisting of the softest and richest yellow mud, so that we were obliged as a preliminary to build a causeway of stout branches and twigs. Having also put on radiant moccasins, procured from a squaw of Richard's establishment, and made what other improvements our narrow circumstances allowed, we took our seats on the grass with a feeling of greatly increased respectability, to wait the arrival of our guests. They came, the banquet was concluded, and the pipe smoked. Bidding them adieu, we turned our horses' heads toward the fort. An hour elapsed. The barren hills closed across our front, and we could see no farther, until, having surmounted them, a rapid stream appeared at the foot of the descent running into the Platte. Beyond was a green meadow dotted with bushes, and in the midst of these, at the point where the two rivers joined, were the low clay walls of a fort. This was not Fort Laramie, but another post of less recent date, which, having sunk before its successful competitor, was now deserted and ruinous. A moment after, the hill, seeming to draw apart as we advanced, disclosed Fort Laramie itself, its high bastions and perpendicular walls of clay crowning an eminence on the left beyond the stream, while behind stretched a line of arid and desolate ridges, and behind these again, towering aloft 7,000 feet, arose the grim Black Hills. We tried to ford Laramie Creek at a point nearly opposite the fort, but the stream, swollen with the rains in the mountains, was too rapid. We passed up along its bank to find a better crossing place. Men gathered on the wall to look at us. "There's Bordeaux," called Henry, his face brightening as he recognized his acquaintance. "Him there with the spyglass. And there's old Vasquez, and Tucker, and May. And by George, there's Simoneau." This Simoneau was Henry's fast friend, and the only man in the country who could rival him in hunting. We soon found a ford. Henry led the way, the pony approaching the bank with a countenance of cool indifference, bracing his feet and sliding into the stream with the most unmoved composure. At the first plunge the horse sunk low, and the water broke o'er the saddle bow. We followed. The water boiled against our saddles, but our horses bore us easily through. The unfortunate little mules came near going down with the current, cart and all, and we watched them with some solicitude scrambling over the loose round stones at the bottom and bracing stoutly against the stream. All landed safely at last. We crossed a little plain, descended a hollow, and riding up a steep bank found ourselves before the gateway of Fort Laramie, under the impending blockhouse erected above it to defend the entrance. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of the Oregon Trail. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Oregon Trail by Francis Parkman, Jr. Chapter 9. Scenes at Fort Laramie. Looking back after the expiration of a year upon Fort Laramie and its inmates, they seem less like a reality than like some fanciful picture of the olden time, so different was the scene from any which this tamer side of the world can present. Tall Indians, enveloped in their white buffalo robes, were striding across the area,
or reclining at full length on the low roofs of the buildings which enclosed it. Numerous squaws, gaily bedizened, sat grouped in front of the apartments they occupied. Their mongrel offspring, restless and vociferous, rambled in every direction through the fort, and the trappers, traders, and engagés of the establishment were busy at their labor or their amusements. We were met at the gate, but by no means cordially welcomed. Indeed, we seemed objects of some distrust and suspicion, until Henry Chatillon explained that we were not traders, and we, in confirmation, handed to the bourgeois a letter of introduction from his principals. He took it, turned it upside down, and tried hard to read it. But his literary attainments not being adequate to the task, he applied for relief to the clerk, a sleek, smiling Frenchman named Montalon. The letter read, Bordeaux, the bourgeois, seemed gradually to awaken to a sense of what was expected of him. Though not deficient in hospitable intentions, he was wholly unaccustomed to act as a master of ceremonies. Discarding all formalities of reception, he did not honor us with a single word, but walked swiftly across the area, while we followed in some admiration to a railing and a flight of steps opposite the entrance. He signed to us that we had better fasten our horses to the railing. Then he walked up the steps, tramped along a rude balcony, and, kicking open a door, displayed a large room, rather more elaborately finished than a barn. For furniture it had a rough bedstead, but no bed, two chairs, a chest of drawers, a tin pail to hold water, and a board to cut tobacco upon. A brass crucifix hung on the wall, and close at hand a recent scalp with hair full a yard long was suspended from a nail. I shall again have occasion to mention this dismal trophy, its history being connected with that of our subsequent proceedings. This apartment, the best in Fort Laramie, was that usually occupied by the legitimate bourgeois Papin, in whose absence the command devolved upon Bordeaux. The latter, a stout, bluff little fellow, much inflated by a sense of his new authority, began to roar for buffalo robes. These being brought and spread upon the floor formed our beds, much better ones than we had of late been accustomed to. Our arrangements made, we stepped out to the balcony to take a more leisurely survey of the long-looked-for haven at which we had arrived at last. Beneath us was the square area surrounded by little rooms, or rather cells, which opened upon it. These were devoted to various purposes, but served chiefly for the accommodation of the men employed at the fort, or of the equally numerous squaws whom they were allowed to maintain in it. Opposite to us rose the blockhouse above the gateway. It was adorned with a figure which even now haunts my memory, a horse at full speed, dabbed upon the boards with red paint, and exhibiting a degree of skill which might rival that displayed by the Indians in executing similar designs upon their robes and lodges. A busy scene was enacting in the area. The wagons of Vasquez, an old trader, were about to set out for a remote post in the mountains, and the Canadians were going through their preparations with all possible bustle, while here and there an Indian stood looking on with imperturbable gravity. Fort Laramie is one of the posts established by the American Fur Company, who well-nigh monopolized the Indian trade of this whole region. Here their officials rule with an absolute sway. The arm of the United States has little force, for when we were there, the extreme outposts of her troops were about 700 miles to the eastward. The little fort is built of bricks dried in the sun, and externally is of an oblong form, with bastions of clay in the form of ordinary blockhouses at two of the corners. The walls are about 15 feet high, and surmounted by a slender palisade. The roofs of the apartments within, which are built close against the walls, serve the purpose of a banquette. Within, the fort is divided by a partition. On one side is the square area surrounded by the storerooms, offices, and apartments of the inmates. On the other is the corral, a narrow place encompassed by the high clay walls, where at night, or in presence of dangerous Indians, the horses and mules of the fort are crowded for safekeeping. The main entrance has two gates, with an arched passage intervening. A little square window, quite high above the ground, opens laterally from an adjoining chamber into this passage, so that when the inner gate is closed and barred, a person without may still hold communication with those within through this narrow aperture. This obviates the necessity of admitting suspicious Indians for purposes of trading into the body of the fort, for when danger is apprehended, the inner gate is shut fast, and all traffic is carried on by means of the little window. This precaution, though highly necessary at some of the company's posts, is now seldom resorted to at Fort Laramie, where, though men are frequently killed in its neighborhood, no apprehensions are now entertained of any general designs of hostility from the Indians. We did not long enjoy our new quarters undisturbed. The door was silently pushed open, and two eyeballs and a visage as black as night looked in upon us. Then a red arm and shoulder intruded themselves, and a tall Indian, gliding in, shook us by the hand, grunted his salutation, and sat down on the floor. Others followed, with faces of the natural hue, and letting fall their heavy robes from their shoulders, they took their seats, quite at ease, in a semicircle before us. The pipe was now to be lighted and passed round from one to another, and this was the only entertainment that at present they expected from us. These visitors were fathers, brothers, or other relatives of the squaws in the fort, where they were permitted to remain loitering about in perfect idleness. All those who smoked with us were men of standing and repute. Two or three others dropped in also, young fellows who neither by their years nor their exploits were entitled to rank with the old men and warriors, and who, abashed in the presence of their superiors, stood aloof, never withdrawing their eyes from us. Their cheeks were adorned with vermilion, their ears with pendants of shell, and their necks with beads. Never yet having signalized themselves as hunters, or performed the honorable exploit of killing a man, they were held in slight esteem, and were diffident and bashful in proportion. Certain formidable inconveniences attended this influx of visitors. They were bent on inspecting everything in the room. Our equipments and our dress alike underwent their scrutiny. For though the contrary has been carelessly asserted, few beings have more curiosity than Indians in regard to subjects within their ordinary range of thought. As to other matters, indeed, they seemed utterly indifferent. They will not trouble themselves to inquire into what they cannot comprehend, but are quite contented to place their hands over their mouths in token of wonder, and exclaim that it is great medicine. With this comprehensive solution, an Indian never is at a loss. He never launches forth into speculation and conjecture. His reason moves in its beaten track. His soul is dormant, and no exertions of the missionaries, Jesuit or Puritan, of the old world, or of the new, have as yet availed to rouse it. As we were looking at sunset from the wall upon the wild and desolate plains that surround the fort, we observed a cluster of strange objects like scaffolds rising in the distance against the red western sky. They bore aloft some singular-looking burdens, and at their foot glimmered something white like bones. This was the place of sepulture of some Dakota chiefs, whose remains their people are fond of placing in the vicinity of the fort, in the hope that they may thus be protected from violation at the hands of their enemies. Yet it has happened more than once, and quite recently, that war parties of the Crow Indians, ranging through the country, have thrown the bodies from the scaffolds and broken them to pieces amid the yells of the Dakotas who remained pent up in the fort, too few to defend the honored relics from insult. The white objects upon the ground were buffalo skulls, arranged in the mystic circle commonly seen at Indian places of sepulture upon the prairie. We soon discovered, in the twilight, a band of 50 or 60 horses approaching the fort. These were the animals belonging to the establishment, who, having been sent out to feed under the care of armed guards in the meadows below, were now being driven into the corral for the night. A little gate opened into this enclosure. By the side of it stood one of the guards, an old Canadian with gray, bushy eyebrows, and a dragoon pistol stuck into his belt. while his comrade mounted on horseback, his rifle laid across the saddle in front of him and his long hair blowing before his swarthy face, rode at the rear of the disorderly troop, urging them up the ascent. In a moment the narrow corral was thronged with the half-wild horses, kicking, biting, and crowding restlessly together. The discordant jingling of a bell rung by a Canadian in the area summoned us to supper. This sumptuous repast was served on a rough table in one of the lower apartments of the fort, and consisted of cakes of bread and dried buffalo meat, an excellent thing for strengthening the teeth. At this meal were seated the bourgeois and superior dignitaries of the establishment, among whom Henry Chatillon was worthily included. No sooner was it finished than the table was spread a second time, the luxury of bread being now, however, omitted, for the benefit of certain hunters and trappers of an inferior standing, while the ordinary Canadian engagés were regaled on dried meat in one of their lodging rooms. By way of illustrating the domestic economy of Fort Laramie, it may not be amiss to introduce in this place a story current among the men when we were there. There was an old man named Pierre, whose duty it was to bring the meat from the storeroom for the men. Old Pierre, in the kindness of his heart, used to select the fattest and the best pieces for his companions. This did not long escape the keen-eyed bourgeois, who was greatly disturbed at such improvidence, and cast about for some means to stop it. At last he hit on a plan that exactly suited him. At the side of the meat room, and separated from it by a clay partition, was another compartment used for the storage of furs. It had no other communication with the fort except through a square hole in the partition, and of course it was perfectly dark. One evening the bourgeois, watching for a moment when no one observed him, dodged into the meat room, clambered through the hole, and ensconced himself among the furs and buffalo robes. Soon after, old Pierre came in with his lantern, and, muttering to himself, began to pull over the bales of meat and select the best pieces as usual. But suddenly a hollow and sepulchral voice proceeded from the inner apartment. "Pierre, Pierre, let that fat meat alone. Take nothing but lean." Pierre dropped his lantern and bolted out into the fort, screaming in an agony of terror that the devil was in the storeroom. But tripping on the threshold, he pitched over upon the gravel and lay senseless, stunned by the fall. The Canadians ran out to the rescue. Some lifted the unlucky Pierre, and others, making an extempore crucifix out of two sticks, were proceeding to attack the devil in his stronghold, when the bourgeois, with a crestfallen countenance, appeared at the door. To add to the bourgeois' mortification, he was obliged to explain the whole stratagem to Pierre, in order to bring the latter to his senses. We were sitting on the following morning in the passageway between the gates, conversing with the traders Vasquez and May. These two men, together with our sleek friend, the clerk Montalon, were, I believe, the only persons then in the fort who could read and write. May was telling a curious story about the traveler Catlin, when an ugly, diminutive Indian, wretchedly mounted, came up at a gallop and rode past us into the fort. On being questioned, he said that Smoke's village was close at hand. Accordingly, only a few minutes elapsed before the hills beyond the river were covered with a disorderly swarm of savages on horseback and on foot. May finished his story, and by that time the whole array had descended to Laramie Creek and commenced crossing it in a mass. I walked down to the bank. The stream is wide, and was then between 3 and 4 feet deep, with a very swift current. For several rods the water was alive with dogs, horses, and Indians. The long poles used in erecting the lodges are carried by the horses, being fastened by the heavier end, 2 or 3 on each side, to a rude sort of pack-saddle, while the other end drags on the ground. About a foot behind the horse, a kind of large basket or pannier is suspended between the poles, and firmly lashed in its place on the back of the horse are piled various articles of luggage. The basket also is well filled with domestic utensils, or, quite as often, with a litter of puppies, a brood of small children, or a superannuated old man. Numbers of these curious vehicles, called in the bastard language of the country travaux, were now splashing together through the stream. Among them swam countless dogs, often burdened with miniature travaux, and dashing forward on horseback through the throng came the superbly formed warriors, the slender figure of some lynx-eyed boy clinging fast behind them. The women sat perched on the pack saddles, adding not a little to the load of the already overburdened horses. The confusion was prodigious. The dogs yelled and howled in chorus. The puppies in the travaux set up a dismal whine as the water invaded their comfortable retreat. The little black-eyed children, from 1 year of age upward, clung fast with both hands to the edge of their basket, and looked over in alarm at the water rushing so near them, sputtering and making wry mouths as it splashed against their faces. Some of the dogs, encumbered by their loads, were carried down by the current, yelping piteously, and the old squaws would rush into the water, seize their favorites by the neck, and drag them out. As each horse gained the bank, he scrambled up as he could. Stray horses and colts came among the rest, often breaking away at full speed through the crowd, followed by the old hag screaming after their fashion on all occasions of excitement. Buxom young squaws, blooming in all the charms of vermilion, stood here and there on the bank, holding aloft their master's lance as a signal to collect the scattered portions of his household. In a few moments the crowd melted away, each family with its horses and equipage filing off to the plain at the rear of the fort. And here, in the space of half an hour, arose 60 or 70 of their tapering lodges. Their horses were feeding by hundreds over the surrounding prairie, and their dogs were roaming everywhere. The fort was full of men, and the children were whooping and yelling incessantly under the walls. These newcomers were scarcely arrived when Bordeaux was running across the fort, shouting to his squaw to bring him his spyglass. The obedient Marie, the very model of a squaw, produced the instrument, and Bordeaux hurried with it up to the wall. Pointing it to the eastward, he exclaimed with an oath that the families were coming. But a few moments elapsed before the heavy caravan of the emigrant wagons could be seen, steadily advancing from the hills. They gained the river, and without turning or pausing, plunged in. They passed through, and slowly ascending the opposing bank, kept directly on their way past the fort and the Indian village, until, gaining a spot a quarter of a mile distant, they wheeled into a circle. For some time our tranquility was undisturbed. The emigrants were preparing their encampment, but no sooner was this accomplished than Fort Laramie was fairly taken by storm. A crowd of broad-brimmed hats, thin visages, and staring eyes appeared suddenly at the gate. Tall, awkward men in brown homespun, women with cadaverous faces and long, lank figures came thronging in together, and, as if inspired by the very demon of curiosity, ransacked every nook and corner of the fort. Dismayed at this invasion, we withdrew in all speed to our chamber, vainly hoping that it might prove an inviolable sanctuary. The emigrants prosecuted their investigations with untiring vigor. They penetrated the rooms, or rather dens, inhabited by the astonished squaws. They explored the apartments of the men, and even that of Marie and the bourgeois. At last a numerous deputation appeared at our door, but were immediately expelled. Being totally devoid of any sense of delicacy or propriety, they seemed resolved to search every mystery to the bottom. Having at length satisfied their curiosity, they next proceeded to business. The men occupied themselves in procuring supplies for their onward journey, either buying them with money or giving in exchange superfluous articles of their own. The emigrants felt a violent prejudice against the French Indians, as they called the trappers and traders. They thought, and with some justice, that these men bore them no good will. Many of them were firmly persuaded that the French were instigating the Indians to attack and cut them off. On visiting the encampment, we were at once struck with the extraordinary perplexity and indecision that prevailed among the emigrants. They seemed like men totally out of their elements, bewildered and amazed like a troop of schoolboys lost in the woods. It was impossible to be long among them without being conscious of the high and bold spirit with which most of them were animated. But the forest is the home of the backwoodsman. On the remote prairie he is totally at a loss. He differs much from the genuine mountain man, the wild prairie hunter, as a Canadian voyageur paddling his canoe on the rapids of the Ottawa differs from an American sailor among the storms of Cape Horn. Still, my companion and I were somewhat at a loss to account for this perturbed state of mind. It could not be cowardice. These men were of the same stock with the volunteers of Monterey and Buena Vista. Yet, for the most part, they were the rudest and most ignorant of the frontier population. They knew absolutely nothing of the country and its inhabitants. They had already experienced much misfortune and apprehended more. They had seen nothing of mankind, and had never put their own resources to the test. A full proportion of suspicion fell upon us. Being strangers, we were looked upon as enemies. Having occasion for a supply of lead and a few other necessary articles, we used to go over to the emigrant camps to obtain them. After some hesitation, some dubious glances, and fumbling of the hands in the pockets, the terms would be agreed upon, the price tendered, and the emigrant would go off to bring the article in question. After waiting until our patience gave out, we would go in search of him, and find him seated on the tongue of his wagon. "Well, stranger," he would observe as he saw us approach, "I reckon I won't trade." Some friend of his followed him from the scene of the bargain, and suggested in his ear that clearly we meant to cheat him, and he had better have nothing to do with us. This timorous mood of the emigrants was doubly unfortunate, as it exposed them to real danger. Assume in the presence of Indians a bold bearing, self-confident yet vigilant, and you will find them tolerably safe neighbors. But your safety depends on the respect and fear you are able to inspire. If you betray timidity or indecision, you convert them from that moment into insidious and dangerous enemies. The Dakotas saw clearly enough the perturbation of the emigrants and instantly availed themselves of it. They became extremely insolent and exacting in their demands. It has become an established custom with them to go to the camp of every party as it arrives in succession at the fort and demand a feast. Smoke's village had come with the express design, having made several days' journey with no other object than that of enjoying a cup of coffee and two or three biscuits. So the feast was demanded, and the emigrants dared not refuse it. One evening, about sunset, the village was deserted. We met old men, warriors, squaws, and children in gay attire trooping off to the encampment with faces of anticipation, and arriving here, they seated themselves in a semicircle. Smoke occupied the center, with his warriors on either hand. The young men and boys next succeeded, and the squaws and children formed the horns of the crescent. The biscuit and coffee were most promptly dispatched, the emigrants staring open-mouthed at their savage guests. With each new emigrant party that arrived at Fort Laramie, this scene was renewed, and every day the Indians grew more rapacious and presumptuous. One evening they broke to pieces, out of mere wantonness, the cups from which they had been feasted, and this so exasperated the emigrants that many of them seized their rifles and could scarcely be restrained from firing on the insolent mob of Indians. Before we left the country, this dangerous spirit on the part of the Dakota had mounted to a yet higher pitch. They began openly to threaten the emigrants with destruction, and actually fired upon one or two parties of whites. A military force and military law are urgently called for in that perilous region, and unless troops are speedily stationed at Fort Laramie or elsewhere in the neighborhood, both the emigrants and other travelers will be exposed to most imminent risks. The Ogallala, the Brules, and other western bands of the Dakota are thorough savages, unchanged by any contact with civilization. Not one of them can speak a European tongue or has ever visited an American settlement. Until within a year or two, when the emigrants began to pass through their country on the way to Oregon, they had seen no whites, except the handful employed about the Fur Company's posts. They esteemed them a wise people, inferior only to themselves, living in leather lodges like their own, and subsisting on buffalo. but when the swarm of Meneaska, with their oxen and wagons, began to invade them, their astonishment was unbounded. They could scarcely believe that the earth contained such a multitude of white men. Their wonder is now giving way to indignation, and the result, unless vigilantly guarded against, may be lamentable in the extreme. But to glance at the interior of a lodge. Shaw and I used often to visit them. Indeed, we spent most of our evenings in the Indian village, Shaw's assumption of the medical character giving us a fair pretext. As a sample of the rest, I will describe one of these visits. The sun had just set, and the horses were driven into the corral. The prairie cock, a noted beau, came in at the gate with a bevy of young girls, with whom he began to dance in the area, leading them round and round in a circle, while he jerked up from his chest a succession of monotonous sounds, and to which they kept time in a rueful chant. Outside the gate, boys and young men were idly frolicking, and close by, looking grimly upon them, stood a warrior in his robe, with his face painted jet black, in token that he had lately taken a Pawnee scalp. Passing these, the tall dark lodges rose between us and the red western sky. We repaired at once to the lodge of Old Smoke himself. It was by no means better than the others. Indeed, it was rather shabby, for in this democratic community the chief never assumes superior state. Smoke sat cross-legged on a buffalo robe, and his grunt of salutation as we entered was unusually cordial, out of respect, no doubt, to Shaw's medical character. Seated around the lodge were several squaws and an abundance of children. The complaint of Shaw's patients was, for the most part, a severe inflammation of the eyes occasioned by exposure to the sun, a species of disorder which he treated with some success. He had brought with him a homeopathic medicine chest, and was, I presume, the first who introduced that harmless system of treatment among the Ogallala. No sooner had a robe been spread at the head of the lodge for our accommodation, and we had seated ourselves upon it, than a patient made her appearance. The chief's daughter herself, who, to do her justice, was the best-looking girl in the village. Being on excellent terms with the physician, she placed herself readily under his hands, and submitted with a good grace to his applications, laughing in his face during the process, for a squaw hardly knows how to smile. This case dispatched, another of a different kind succeeded. A hideous, emaciated old woman sat in the darkest corner of the lodge, rocking to and fro with pain, and hiding her eyes from the light by pressing the palms of her hands against her face. At Smoke's command she came forward, very unwillingly, and exhibited a pair of eyes that had nearly disappeared from excess of inflammation. No sooner had the doctor fastened his grips upon her than she set up a dismal moaning, and writhed so in his grasp that he lost all patience. But being resolved to carry his point, he succeeded at last in applying his favorite remedies. "It is strange," he said, when the operation was finished, "that I forgot to bring any Spanish flies with me. We must have something here to answer for a counter-irritant." So in the absence of better, he seized upon a red-hot brand from the fire and clapped it against the temple of the old squaw, who set up an unearthly howl, at which the rest of the family broke out into a laugh. During these medical operations, Smoke's eldest squaw entered the lodge with a sort of stone mallet in her hand. I had observed some time before a litter of well-grown black puppies comfortably nestled among some buffalo robes at one side, but this newcomer speedily disturbed their enjoyment, for seizing one of them by the hind paw, she dragged him out, and carrying him to the entrance of the lodge, hammered him on the head till she killed him. Being quite conscious to what this preparation tended, I looked through a hole in the back of the lodge to see the next steps of the process. The squaw, holding the puppy by the legs, was swinging him to and fro through the blaze of a fire until the hair was singed off. This done, she unsheathed her knife and cut him into small pieces, which she dropped into a kettle to boil. In a few moments a large wooden dish was set before us, filled with this delicate preparation. We felt conscious of the honor. A dog feast is the greatest compliment a Dakota can offer to his guest, and knowing that to refuse eating would be an affront, we attacked the little dog and devoured him before the eyes of his unconscious parent. Smoke, in the meantime, was preparing his great pipe. It was lighted when we had finished our repast, and we passed it from one to another till the bowl was empty. This done, we took our leave without further ceremony, knocked at the gate of the fort, and after making ourselves known, were admitted. One morning, about a week after reaching Fort Laramie, we were holding our customary Indian levee, when a bustle in the area below announced a new arrival. And looking down from our balcony, I saw a familiar red beard and mustache in the gateway. They belonged to the captain, who with his party had just crossed the stream. We met him on the stairs as he came up, and congratulated him on the safe arrival of himself and his devoted companions. But he remembered our treachery, and was grave and dignified accordingly, a tendency which increased as he observed on our part a disposition to laugh at him. After remaining an hour or two at the fort, he rode away with his friends, and we have heard nothing of him since. As for R., he kept carefully aloof. It was but too evident that we had the unhappiness to have forfeited the kind regards of our London fellow traveler. End of chapter 9.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.